The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University. Today, I'm here to talk to Dr. Stephen Searles, the author of The Impoverishment of the African Red Sea Littoral from 1640 to 1945, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2018. Dr. Stephen Searles is a research fellow at the Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient. He holds a PhD in history from McGill University. He previously was a fellow at Harvard University Center for Madrasian Studies and Martin Luther Universitat, Halle-Wittenberg Center for Interdisciplinary Regional Studies. He's the author of Starvation and the State, Famine, Slavery, and Power in Sudan from 1883 to 1956, published by Palgrave Macmillan 2013. And the book that we are going to talk about today, The Impoverishment of the African Red Sea Littoral from 1640 to 1945, is his latest publication as a monograph. We will explore the African Red Sea Littoral. It is currently divided between Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Djibouti, and often in the news, as the book cover says, as in these days, as one of the poorest regions in the world. But the pastoralist communities indigenous to this region were not always poor, historically. They had access to a variety of resources that allowed them to prosper in the harsh, arid environment. This access was mediated by a robust moral economy of pastoralism that acted as a social safety net. Stephen Searles charts the erosion of this moral economy, a slow-moving process that began during the Little Ice Age mega drought of the 17th and 18th centuries and continued throughout the devastating famines of the 20th century. By examining mass sedentarization after the Second World War as merely that the latest manifestation of an intergenerational environmental and economic crisis, this book offers an innovative lens for understanding poverty in northeastern Africa within the Indian Ocean world. Welcome, Stephen, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
We are glad to have you. We start by learning about the author. So can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in the Red Sea and the African littoral of the Red Sea, and if you had any influential mentors you would like to mention?
Sure. I was born in New York, and I have a kind of very roundabout course towards studying this part of the world. Before studying history, I went to university to study chemical engineering. And then I went to university to study fine art and then history. And when I started my master's in history, I was interested in the history of cities, something that developed while I was a art student. I was interested in the history of cities, urban culture, the built urban environment. And this led to my master's thesis, which is about the building of the city of Khartoum, which was planned from nothing by the British in the first decade of the 20th century, as a model healthy city for white people to live in Africa, which I found very interesting. The guy who designed the city also went on to design the first modern plan for Jerusalem and also the redesign of Alexandria in the 1920s. And that got me interested in Sudan and the history of Sudan. And my PhD work was began in, as a kind of broader contextualization of that project, and then led to really examining the history of famine in Sudan. And as I was writing my dissertation, which became my first book, I really came to understand famine as a kind of, as a special case of poverty. That it really is a kind of poverty, an extreme example of it. And that led me to think about poverty as a kind of broader topic. And often we don't talk specifically about poverty or impoverishment enough as historians. It's somehow we talk around the edges of poverty, and I try to work on something that looked directly at poverty both as a kind of process, a historical process, and also that has real material consequences for the people who end up living in poverty. And in part, methodologically, my work is really, I'm an economic historian that grounds my work very strongly in environmental history. And in this, I owe a debt of gratitude to Dr. Gwynne Campbell, who's the head of the Indian Ocean World Center at McGill University. He was my PhD supervisor, and he was really the perhaps the most influential person in terms of my own research. I began working with him as a master's student shortly after coming to history from fine arts, and it was through conversations with him and understanding the work that's going on at the Indian Ocean World Center that I really understood how to look at the impact of changes in the natural environment on human civilization.
Thank you for sharing that. I would like to know how the book idea developed, if you can talk about the research process and the writing experience.
Sure. So the part of the idea for the book and part of what was going on in terms of my early research on the book is... I was interested in trying to write a history of people that are not completely captured in the archival record. Pastoralists have a tendency to move away from governments, especially colonial governments, who are trying to pin them down, who are trying to collect taxes from them, to force them into sedentarization, to appropriate resources from them. They have kind of a reason to be suspicious, and the end result is that the historical archival record doesn't capture them completely. In my PhD, which became my first book, I look partially at Eastern Sudan, because that is one of the places where the British colonial administration began before the conquest of Sudan in the 1890s. They ruled Eastern Sudan from 1885, parts of it. And I understood that there were things that were not being captured in the record because the people were moving away from British territory into Italian territory, coming from Italian territory into British territory. And so then I began the project as one of looking across archival records to figure out what's going on the other side of the border. So I began by looking at Italian records to try to figure out what's going on in Eastern Sudan, and that led to really understanding that there's patterns that are happening across different pastoral groups that are becoming divided between different colonial territories, and that these patterns can actually fill in the gaps from the documentary record that is often very scarce. And that's how I began. And then it became a process. I thought that this was really going to be a colonial history, as my previous one was, but the start date became very unsatisfactory. Like, it became hard to imagine really beginning a work based on the idea of this is the day where the first European came, when it took a very long time for Europeans to amass enough power in the region that they could influence pastoralists and the pastoralist ways of living. And so then it became kind of an exercise in going back and to try to understand that where the origins of this process of impoverization began. And I ended up locating it in the 17th century. And then I followed that process as it unfolds. And it helped me to create a kind of a different kind of history of the region that appropriately decenters the colonial state, especially which I think is especially appropriate when talking about people who have a kind of uneasy relationships with state and state power anyway.
Mm-hmm. I would like now to learn more about the book and its chapters. The book consists of 7 chapters organized chronologically and thematically. The first one, the introduction, Becoming Poor. What characterizes the African Red Sea littoral as a region and its economy, which that based on pastoralism and its pastoralist communities? And how would you situate it in the broader African and the Indian Ocean context?
That's a great question. I think it is a region that is defined by a kind of historic pattern of human environment interaction. There's certain common environmental features across this relatively large geographic area that encourages certain types of patterns of human environment interaction. So the first most important feature is that this is an arid or semi-arid region in which rain-fed agriculture is not possible. But it is a region where also there are multiple different seasons of different pastures. So there's often a lowland pasture season and an upland pasture season, because this region is the region that is between the sea and either the Nile, in the case of Sudan, or the sea and the Ethiopian plateau. And so pastoralists move up and down from the plateaus in chasing pastures. And then also the region, because of its proximity to the Ethiopian plateau, it also has access to these, bisected by these torrential rivers that flow only when there is rain in the highlands. And this allows for a certain kind of safety and security in terms of pastoralists, because if pastures fail, either the lowland or middle plateau pastures fail, then they're able to take their animals into these torrential rivers. And also the torrential rivers allow the ability for some kind of seasonal cultivation to be engaged in. And as a result, across this region, you have a kind of multifaceted strategy that uses different kinds of resources that at different times of the year and in different ways that are not necessarily interrelated with each other, that allow for the supporting of human civilization in a relatively arid region. People raise animals, people engaged in some amount of cultivation, people did some amount of salt farming or salt mining, they were able to produce handicrafts. They also engaged very importantly in the transport trade. There is a millennia-long trade in the Red Sea connecting the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. This trade passes from coastal ports across caravan routes to inland markets, and these pastoralists were involved in that.
And how would you say the African context and the Indian Ocean context were shaping this region?
So I think of this region as very much embedded within the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean world. And I think it's very important to think of this region within the Indian Ocean world. It actually creates the parameters of kind of the broader Red Sea space. Typically, we assume this part of the world to be part of the Horn of Africa and to have a kind of terrestrial understanding of its relationships. Internal relationships, and then the relationships to neighboring populations. But actually, it's better to think of this, think of the connection as across the sea and to the Indian Ocean. The trade with India historically was incredibly important for the region. It is part of what allowed in neighboring states for a kind of social differentiation. It's the way elites in Sudan and Ethiopia might indicate themselves as elites as through their access to trade goods from India. But also international trade via the Indian Ocean was structurally important to every part of life, especially in the littoral area where people often ate food, rice, grains, sorghum that was exported from the Indian Ocean, from India or the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea. It is part of what allowed people to focus on pastoralism and only to have to engage in cultivation as a kind of supplementary activity because they were able to purchase food regularly. There was a continuous supply of food as a result of this trade. There also was wealth that was coming in. There was the ability to earn money and purchase imported goods that long predates the introduction of steamers and steamships and kind of international fast moving maritime and air transport of the 19th and 20th century. And as a result, thinking of this region as just an African region or an African region in the sense of it's in Africa, cut off from anything that is not Africa, is unproductive. And it's better to think of this region as a kind of part of a global world that predates the kind of modern transportation revolution.
Mm-hmm. This is very helpful. And in the previous podcast, I've interviewed Omar Ali on his book, Malik Ambar, and we touched on the Red Sea slavery trade, and also Alexis Wick, The Lost Space book on the Ottoman Red Sea. And now we are talking about another history and dimension of the Red Sea. And this is very helpful. In the second chapter, Survival by Conversion, from 1640 to 1840, the book charts the process of impoverishment from from its origins in the Little Ice Age mega drought until the end of the Second World War. If you would explain briefly the Little Ice Age for the listeners who are not familiar with this phenomena, and what were some of the environmental and cultural turning points in the history of the African Red Sea littoral from the early modern to the modern period?
Sure. So the Little Ice Age is a little bit of a kind of controversial term. There is some debate about whether or not it existed, whether or not it was cold, when it began and when it ended. What is clear is that there was some kind of climatological irregularity that began in the 17th century that presented itself differently in different parts of the world. In Europe, this is very well studied. I think that there was a kind of extreme cold period. That's why it's called the Little Ice Age. But in other regions, it presented itself very differently. In the part of the world that I study, in the African Red Sea littoral, it presented itself as a kind of unusual dry period. This unusual dry period lasted for about 200 years. It doesn't mean that it was only dry, that there was never rain, that it was never wet, there was never pastures. It just meant that the frequency in which droughts happened increased, that the amount of rain when it fell was much less, and that this what I show over the course of this chapter, and then I think, I hope, show the legacy over the course of the book, is that this really disrupted a long-standing balance in the region, that this complicated strategy using a bunch of different resources that are not intertwined with each other, that allowed for the maintenance of human civilization in this region, in this very harsh region, got disrupted as pastures moved away. So the more north in this region, so towards the Egyptian, towards the middle of Eastern Sudan, became drier and drier. And as a result, there's a kind of a push of populations down from Eastern Sudan towards the Eritrean border. There's some wars, displacement, longstanding ethnic groups disappear, get assimilated into other ones, new ones emerge. But in it, beyond this is a kind of two-part problem that emerges. On the one hand, this is a regional drought. This drought occurs also in the Ethiopian highlands, which means that there's not the same amount of water flowing through the Nile. As a result, this puts a lot of pressure on states in Ethiopia and in Sudan who are not really able to perform a lot of the functions that they normally performed, including the redistribution of grain during periods of environmental stress and famines, droughts. And as a result, they fall apart, and so trade falls apart. So this is like one avenue of potential economic profit for the pastoralists that I study. And then also at the same time, it becomes hard for them to maintain themselves on their own lands. The pastures are not there. The torrential rivers don't necessarily have the water that should be in them to act as a drought pasture reserve. And people struggle, and they struggle for a very, very, very long time. I mean, they try throughout the region, not just the pastoralists, but the settled areas. People try at first to make very conservative kinds of changes, maybe pasture a little bit further south, maybe cultivate a little bit further up into the highlands for settled populations in Ethiopia. And this doesn't, you know, generation after generation after generation, they struggle to make something happen. And after over a century of trying to maintain a status quo that is becoming increasingly untenable, a whole cascade of transformations happens very suddenly at the turn of from the 18th to the 19th century. In Sudan and in Ethiopia, you have a kind of disintegration of central power. In the pastoral regions that I study, you have a sudden mass conversion to Islam, that these populations had for a long time had varying levels of interaction with Muslim traders, with the broader Muslim world. They're at the edge of the Red Sea. They're near Mecca, Medina. But nonetheless, they had maintained distance, a religious, theological distance from Islam. And at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, they convert and become adherents of various different kinds of Sufi brotherhoods that preach a very concrete ideology of divine intercession in this world, that the leaders of these brotherhoods are able to channel channel spiritual forces in ways that could create pastures, bring water, bring rain. And as a result, this I argue in the book is part of the appeal. It's why this becomes a viable strategy for coping with an environment that is no longer that people are no longer capable of coping with. And the end result is you have the emergence at the end of around 1820 of these kind of trans-ethnic religious groups who have relatively wide geographic spread, and their leaders are now competing with the longstanding pastoralist political elites who have been having trouble keeping their adherence to them, because they're not able themselves, like the Ethiopian state and the Sudanese state, to perform some of their central functions, which is providing this kind of social safety net that during famines and droughts and periods of other periods of economic and environmental stress, which is the there is a longstanding quid pro quo that undergirds hierarchical social arrangements in this region, which is during times of plenty, men and women are expected to provide more than their share to the elites. And in return, during times of dearth, these elites are expected to provide back. And this was not possible at the state level in neighboring Sudan and Ethiopia, leading to the dissolution of centralized Ethiopian and Sudanese state, as I think is better studied. And amongst pastoralists, this led to this weakening of political elite power and the emergence of this kind of counter power represented by Sufi brotherhoods and their leadership.
I really enjoyed and appreciated this chapter in which you sketched two centuries. And this is really admirable, trying to bring together environmental relationships and also cultural structures, becoming increasingly intertwined during this period. And the third chapter, Divided and Conquered from 1840 to 1883, you zoom in to look at the winners and the losers in the aftermath of the mega drought after the return of winter conditions in 1840. What are the major developments that you observed during these four decades?
Sure. The part of what I'm trying to do, what I tried to do in this chapter, is to understand, to contextualize and to understand what happened, the rise of Egypt as a Red Sea power in general, and then also very specifically as the colonial ruler over these pastoralist groups. Though Egypt is equally dependent on the same climatological patterns as Sudan, neighboring Sudan and Ethiopia, in the sense that they're all dependent on rainfall patterns in the Ethiopian plateau, because that is what controls the Nile flood. Egypt emerges during the mega drought as actually stronger than it had been prior. The rulers of Egypt over the course of the 18th century engage in a process of improving and fixing irrigation technologies, irrigation systems that allows actually for an expansion of grain yields during this period, unlike what happens in Sudan and Ethiopia, where you have a sharp contraction. These excess grain yields that the state is able to command allows for the expansion of the state, the expansion of the army, and this new Egyptian might is flexed at the beginning of the 20th century at the beginning of the 19th century by Muhammad Ali, where he goes to conquers the Hejaz, the eastern Mediterranean, Sudan, and eventually this area that I study. So that's one part of what happened. So there's this rise of Egypt that is caused in part by an ability to do hydrological management at a time when everyone else is unable to do so. And then at the same time, within the way Egypt actually rules locally, is in this, for pastoralists, Egypt becomes very savvy. The Egyptian rulers understand very quickly that there are competing interests in this area, and that the best way to rule is to support one against the other. And these two interests are what emerged at the end of the mega drought. It's these political elites versus these new religious elites, and the Egyptian rulers offer their new allies, first the political elites, and then this also, there's some fluctuation in policy over the 40 or so years that they ruled this region. First, the political elites, they offer them money, and they offer them, in some cases, arms, and they offer them control against these new theocratic leaders. They disrecognize the theocratic leaders as being representatives of the people. And in so doing, they allow these political, and the deal, the quid pro quo that is there is that these political leaders in exchange for the backing of the Egyptian colonial state, they now need to turn against their own population and turn over tax money at very high rates and exert kind of in an exploitative way to the Egyptian colonial state. And this is really the end of this social safety net that I described earlier, where no longer do political elites, and then eventually when some of the new theological elites get brought into the state, that they don't need to have the buy-in of their population in order to maintain power. What they need is a relationship to an external source in order to do so. And the competition becomes for this. Who can have access to this external source instead of the competition that was emerging at the beginning of the 19th century, which was who would be able to command alliance of the local population. And as a result, this system of social safety net in times of environmental stress, this turning over of food, ensuring that everyone is provided with at least a basic minimum during periods of drought, locust plagues, and other causes of famine, this disappears. And as a result, you begin to have a kind of situation in which it actually becomes untenable to maintain yourself in this harsh environment.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Indeed. And this complements nicely the environmental history works has been done on Egypt during the reign of Muhammad Ali Pasha by historians like Alan Mikael, and you continue the narrative for the southern part, which you don't know much about during this period. You further trace the narrative in the fourth chapter, and I don't know if you intentionally also titled it as War, Disease, Famine, Destruction, as the Four Nights of the Apocalypse in chapter four. We learn about the violent civil war of the 1880s. So what were the factors contributing to this violent civil war, and why is it important to situate the war, as you argue, in regional politics rather than the usual narrative of the Europeans scramble for Africa?
So this gets to this interest. This chapter is like a particular interest to me. I think that African historians have a tendency to overassume the power of the colonial state. There's this idea that the second that there are Europeans that are there present, that they are now the most powerful thing that is on the most powerful presence, that they are the locus of all power. And this, I think, is not true. It's a myth of European power, which I think is not evident. It becomes true, but it takes time for this to become true. And some other kind of dynamic is happening during this period in which it takes time for Europeans to gain power. And so for me, this chapter, I think, is very important because it is the fulcrum point where suddenly there is Europeans come, they become interested. There's a little bit of interest in the 1860s, but really in the 1880s, there's suddenly a strong interest from British, French, and Italian imperial planners in the Red Sea, especially in this part of the Red Sea. And you have them present, but the role that they end up taking on is not as the directors of the fights of conquest. What they end up being is competing external sources of money and guns for these indigenous elites who are themselves still jockeying for power as they had been since this mass conversion at the beginning of the 19th century. There's new players and new sources of money, and this actually acts as a kind of accelerant. There's more ways in which more people can get the guns and the money and the food necessary to field an armed force. In terms of what happens on the ground, what I show is also that the timeline of, like, saying that it's the presence of Europeans that is what is spurring all of this doesn't exactly really line up. That from the 1820s on, there's a kind of environmental recovery. The better, wetter conditions return to the region overall, and there's a resumption of trade. Egyptian power in Sudan allows for trade between Sudan and the Red Sea to increase. A process of centralization of power in Ethiopia begins again, allowing for that trade to increase. There's an overall trade in the Red Sea. It's easier and to maintain herds on pasture lands on the African Red Sea littoral, and yet the population themselves is not getting the benefits that they imagined that they could, which I think is justifiable. And as a result, they chafe at the structures that are there, and they have different interpretations. Different groups of people have different interpretations about who is to blame for the fact that there is an economic recovery, but at the same time that people are still struggling. And in central Sudan begins the Mahdist rebellion, which is something that I deal with in my first book, which is a theologically driven anti-colonial struggle against Egyptians and then against the British, and that leads to the emergence of a theocratic state in central Sudan. This rebellion there inspires other people to elsewhere, including the pastoralists that I study, to themselves rebel. And it's a misunderstanding of the dynamics to say that they just become adherents of this theocratic movement in central Sudan. This is not what happens. It becomes part of the things that are possible that you can do: rebelling, taking up arms against the Egyptian state, against who you think might be their allies, against other groups that you think may have benefited against your own during the previous 200 years. They take them up inspired by the Mahdist rebellion, some of them, but not all of them. Some of them take up arms also claiming support from the new European powers that are there, but they're not for European colonialism. Their expectation, it's very clear from how the leaders of these various armed militias act and what they say they want, is a kind of independence. And the end result is a tragedy. Their fighting becomes deadlier and deadlier as more and more modern arms and ammunitions are introduced into the region. And ultimately, in the midst of all of this, which is something I address, I think, maybe more in the next chapter, Rinderpest is introduced into the region. Rinderpest is a cattle disease that kills 90% of cattle in virgin populations. It was unknown to Africa prior to the end of the 19th century. Probably sometime around 1887, it was imported via the Eritrean port of Massawa. It passed along trade routes to Ethiopia and then South Sudan, then spread throughout the region and then across the African continent, reaching South Africa in 1896. And with this, 90% of the cattle died. And in the Red Sea area, cattle are incredibly important. One, they are a store of wealth. It's what you do with your, it's where the money is. You put the money in herds, in cattle. Cattle herds provide a kind of interest in the form of new animals through natural birth. It's also part of what solidifies social relationships, the lending of cattle across different segments of society, the paying of cattle and bride wealth. And also it's an important productive resource. It's what drives the irrigation water wheels in Sudan. It's what drives the plows in the Ethiopian highlands. And then when they die, all the money is gone and all of the agricultural labor in these two key important parts are gone and food cannot be grown. There just isn't food. There isn't anything. People die in huge numbers. In some areas of the broader region, it's estimated that up to 2/3 of the population die in the beginning of the 1890s.
Mm-hmm. And this grounding of this part of Africa's history and its material conditions is really helpful to historicize conflict in this region as well, because often people assume this perennial violence going on without really grounding it in its historical trajectory. So this has been very helpful. You've mentioned that there was an environmental recovery by the turn of the 19th century. And in chapter 5, you call it an unequal recovery as the title, from 1893 to 1913. I'm curious, what were the main differences in the practices, policies, and attitudes towards the environment between the previous Turco-Egyptian administration and the subsequent British, French, Italian, and Ethiopian empires?
Sure. I think one thing, before I answer that question, I just want to kind of push a little bit more about the idea that there is a recovery happening at this exact time period when Europeans are entering into the scene. So they begin. The Europeans arrive in 1885, just as the civil war is kind of escalating. They're part of the escalation, and then the famine, the Rinderpest happens, and the famine happens. It's a tragedy, and then people try to rebuild. And this is where colonial history, this kind of European colonial history, begins. And this is often overlooked in other histories of this region, or in general in history. African history has this very strong periodization that begins the colonial period at exactly when Europeans arrive. And as a result, often this is missed, that there was something and then there was something else is missed. And so for the people that are living through this, for the pastoralists that I study, they are trying to figure out a new way to live. There are not enough people. They do not have cattle. They cannot maintain themselves as they had previous to the Civil War, and they need to find something to do. And there is a plan that seems to emerge, a kind of grassroots plan that emerges around a shift towards sheep and goats. They survive. Sheep and goats were not affected by this Rinderpest plague. They survive. There seems to be some kind of new sheep sharing arrangements that are happening, communities being emerging around this. And this is happening kind of a little bit outside of the frame of view of Europeans. They don't really understand what is happening. What the Europeans who want to establish themselves as powers in the region, what they want to see is tribes organized by chiefs around chiefs, these chiefs with different various kinds of local titles, but chiefs, that they are the locus of power, they are the locus of control, and it's important to win them over. In part, this is a kind of historical imagination of what Africa is like. This is what Europeans imagine Africa should be. And in part, it is also what they think Egypt had done there. Like the French, the British, and the Italians, they recognize that this region is not terra nullius. They think of it as having been an Egyptian colony, and that Egypt had a set of protocols, and they follow them, at least initially. And this forms the initial template. So they, again, they look for chiefs, they give them salaries, they expect them to turn over taxes. They're not interested in whether or not these chiefs can win the support of their local subaltern population. They think of themselves as being the support. The state is the support for the chiefs, and the chief's job is to act as this agent of the chief and turn over taxes often. That's the main thing that they want, to keep the population quiet. And in some ways, this continues and exacerbates something that is happening under the Egyptians, which is this erosion of a kind of moral economy. So as I said earlier, in Egypt, this moral economy in which local elites are expected to provide, especially in periods of environmental and economic stress, for those that are suffering, the Egyptian colonial state erodes that. And when Europeans come in, it becomes impossible to reconstruct that. And this kind of alternate vision of a non-hierarchical society organized around the ownership of sheep and goats, it cannot come to fruition. And then on top of this, the European powers, to various extents, and differently, I mean, France it organizes itself differently in the region, also Ethiopia, because I deal with some areas that end up within Ethiopian territory, organizes itself slightly differently in the region. But the European imperial powers have this idea that the natural resources of the colony are by default the state's. They do not belong by default to the community, that they are vested within the state. Even if there are community level rights, they are rights that are vested in the state, that the state manages for the community. And you see a kind of willingness to progressively take over various resources that had been important to pastoralist groups in order to maintain themselves, right? Pastoralists don't need just pastures because they don't just own herds. They need access to rivers. They need, in some cases, access to salt deposits, various other things. They need access to trade routes. And these all become vested within the state. And as a result, one by one, as the colonial state emerges, slowly, progressively over decades, these resources are taken away, and it becomes harder and harder for pastoralists to maintain themselves.
Mm-hmm. And despite strategies and changes, you argue in chapter 6 that the cost of living becomes unaffordable between 1913 and 1945. So what do you mean by structural poverty? And how did it take hold among the African Red Sea littoral pastoralists during the interwar period?
Sure. So I think one way to think about this is how is it that we define poverty? I think that we have, there's a kind of conventional idea that poverty is a kind of absolute state. It's that you are you do not have enough. Absolutely. But thinking of it this way, as it's just like a non-fluctuating state, misunderstands actually the kind of context of poverty, that actually we live in a world that is full of change. And we need to be able, in order to be not poor, you need to be not poor in every one of the normal set of conditions that are possible. So with the example of the African Red Sea littoral, it is normal in this region for there to be droughts. Even setting aside the mega drought, this 200-year period where droughts became more frequent, what would normally happen in this region, also in the Red Sea in general, is a drought one out of every 3 years with maybe some good rains in between. They're allowed to be a kind of... It was easy to overcome the drought because people understood that it would be coming, that it was there, and they needed to plan for it. This is they needed to be able to be fine in not just the good periods, not just the okay periods, but also in the bad periods that they can expect. And this is part of why they had built this elaborate moral economy and this strategy of using different kinds of resources in different ways that are independent from each other. And then what happens over the this long story, that by the time we get to after the First World War, that is not possible. What happens is that under okay conditions, under very good conditions, pastoralists were able to continue to survive in their pastures, in the way in which they wanted to continue to survive. But then you would have what otherwise would be a normal 1 year drought, for example, and that would be it. People would suddenly starve. It would cause a famine, which is not a normal response to a normal condition. It should not be that something that can regularly happen should cause suffering on the level of a famine. Something that should regularly happen and historically regularly did happen should be survivable, because that's how you can build a civilization somewhere. And this does not happen there. It becomes impossible. You have this repeatedly in different parts of the region at different times over the period after the First World War, that what otherwise would be a normal famine would lead to catastrophe. And here, what the response becomes a forced move away. I mean, it's not forced in the sense that the state doesn't make them make this choice, but they do not really have a choice. These pastoralists can either stay in their pastures and try and likely suffer from either chronic malnutrition or from famine, or they can give up partially or completely and move to cities. And you have, beginning in this interwar period and then accelerating really after the Second World War, you have a migration to cities and the emergence of the kind of pastoralists that have no herds. This kind of pastoralist in name only, where the dream, the idea, the memory, the self-imagination is as pastoralists whose life is organized around the owning of herds. But the reality is that people are living in improvised communities, improvised shelters on the edges of cities. They're poor, and they have no hope of ever being able to amass the amount of money to be able to invest in animals and be able to move back into pastures and onto the land. And that's what structural poverty is there, that they're stuck. They are stuck being poor in the city, and they're stuck unable to get enough resources to be able to get out of that.
Yes, you close the book by a conclusion that you call being poor. So since the Second World War, what role did pastoralism play in the regional economy of the African Rosiliterate? And how did it factor for the different examined communities and classes during the periods of drought and famine?
I mean, so what you have after the Second World War is really this kind of exactly what I laid out before. You have an abandonment of pastoralism as an economic strategy, as a kind of idea, as an ideal, as a imagined community organization. It maintains itself, but you don't. And this is something also, but you don't have people engaged in this activity in the same way. I mean, there still are some people that there's some percentage that is able to maintain themselves in herds, but you have large groups who are now poor and living on the outskirts of cities, who are from these groups, who imagine themselves as part of these groups, as pastoralists who do not have this. And this chapter, this conclusion in the book, I bring it back to kind of what the introduction of the book is, which is another framing of this overall story, that frames what I'm talking about as a kind of counter narrative to a lot of prevailing scholarship. There is a lot of scholarship, especially from the 1970s on, examining this urbanization in Africa, also including in this region. Why are people moving to the countryside? And they come up with lists of push and pull factors that are pushing people off of the land and pulling people to cities. for some time, it was a vogue amongst various different scholars to try to figure out their own list, to say, no, this pull factor was wrong and this push factor was wrong. But actually, what I try to show and what I try to show over the entirety of the book, and I try to really bring out in the conclusion, is that there is an impediment that is blocking that understanding in those studies from the 1970s on, in that they look only at the recent past to understand what is happening, that they look only to during the Second World War, from the First World War on, from the beginning of the colonial period on, without actually really understanding that there is a longer history to this process of impoverishment that has led to this move to cities, and that this is a much longer one, and that actually the way in which pastoralists were living in the beginning of the 20th century after the First World War was already in a state of crisis. The beginning of the 20th century was a state of crisis, and any imagined relief of current structural poverty in this region that tries to bring people back to a state that they were like at the beginning of the 20th century would just bring them back to crisis. And that it has been a very, very, very long, long drawn out process that has brought people to decide to be put in a position to fundamentally transform the way in which they live and move to a city. That is not something that people wanted to do at the time, as evidenced from a lot of interviews that were conducted in the 1970s and later. And it's something that we as scholars should understand. We need to really pay attention to the magnitude of that kind of change and understand that it comes from something of equal magnitude. And that is what I tried to do in this book, is really show that it took 300 years to get to the point where pastoralists were unable to continue to be pastoralists and therefore had to move to cities.
Indeed. Well, Stephen, this interview can do justice to this book, which is really informative and written in a very succinct and informative and clear way. And I really recommend it as an excellent introduction to this part of the world. At the end, we'd like to know what the authors are working on. I'm not expecting you to be working during this crazy year, but if there are any projects you would like to talk about or you hope to work on.
So I'm working on I have three ongoing projects that are the general direction of my research at the moment and probably going forward. One is I have an interest in the history of money. I'm particularly interested in the spread of the kind of our contemporary modern currency system that links the entire world together. And I have already published some stuff, and I'm working on some other stuff that looks at the spread of colonial currencies in the Red Sea region and links it also to the setting in of structural poverty that people within this region turned to new money forms because they didn't have a choice and they were no longer able to maintain older currency systems in the 20th century. I'm working also on a kind of general history of the Red Sea. And I have done some new work inspired by our current global crisis, looking at the history of disease in the region. I recently published a report for the Rift Valley Institute that looks at the history of syphilis, smallpox, and cholera as a way of trying to figure out what to expect from coronavirus. I published that this summer, and I think that that's the beginning of more research that tries to examine the history of disease in the region as a new way of understanding the history of human civilization there.
All of these sound very interesting, and I know you've published chapters in a series on the Indian Ocean World published by Palgrave Macmillan, which I recommend looking at. Well, thank you for this time, and I hope that the listeners will go and pick up the book and your other book and learn more about the African Red Sea literature. And thank you, everyone, for listening to today's episode in which we explored the impoverishment of the African Red Sea littoral between 1640 to 1945, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2018. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.